Medicine Control Council. But we thought it was going to be important if we had somebody from the department, because some of these things they end up having to be answered by the department. And we are fortunate to have the head of department here. I'm not sure whether, I think she's coming here to cover up the MCC. She likes MCC because she has been there. I'm worried about the laboratory service, but she's not going to cover them because she doesn't like them. She likes MCC. You can see she's sitting between the MCC. No, thank you very much, members. I think we've got a few apologies, but before we go on to the apologies, one of us is at the hospital, is sick. My Honorable Grace Dube fell sick. She told me that she was sick and she was going to a doctor that we had referred her to at Groteskill. And apparently when she got there, they said she needed to be admitted. But what she confused me with, when we were talking, I was asking how she is at the hospital. She said she's at Chris Hani Hospital in Cape Town. Now that really confused me because I wanted to go and see her yesterday. Now I don't know any Chris Hani Hospital. She said, in fact, I said, is it Chris Banner? She said, no, it's Chris Hani. Maybe it's that Chris Banner there. So, members, maybe we need, after this meeting, we'll have to decide. I think we need to go and see her. I asked her whether I can talk about her condition. She said I could because she joined this committee because she's sick. She has always been sick. She's got a condition that they call sarcoidosis. And the way they treat sarcoidosis, they use steroids. And sometimes when you get an overdose of steroids, I'm sure the foodies would agree with me, sometimes you develop diabetes mellitus. And apparently what has happened, that she has developed diabetes mellitus. So she's in that hospital. So we're short of that one member, and I think we need to go and see her in that hospital. Let's hope there's no doctor in that hospital, so they're waiting, and they're going to be able to look after her. So, members, let me just ask Uvega to tell us about the other apologies. That was just one apology. And later on, we'll decide when are we going to go and visit her. In Krisani, in Cape Town.
Good morning, honorable members.
Two apologies. The one for Dr. Bissouli, head of the management in the family, and the other one is for Ms. Khaled Tiswai, who is working in her province.
Thanks for that.
Members are very tired. They don't even say good morning, thanks for it. Good morning, and nobody says good morning. Okay, members, we are going to be doing two things. We are hoping that we're going to be fast. We're going to be looking at the laboratory services and on the agenda. I hope everyone is talking about that. And then later on, we'll be allowing MCC to tell us some of the things that they're actually teaching us. So without wasting time, I think maybe I suspect most of the people that were invited know who you are. And I think some of them are coming from the first time, the second time. Maybe I need to tell them who is here. Or the members that are here, we've got the whip of the committee, Honorable Mr. Mike. Next to him, we've got two honorable members. We've got many ladies in this community. It's only like 10% of some of them are here today. Otherwise, we've got more female than men. We've got two honorable Ndaka Kanari, and we've got two honorable Mike Water. Those are the team from the committee. Mainly because the head of the government for the Ndaka Kanari,
I'm As to how we can introduce measures that can increase capacity in these labs. And Professor Mel Freeman will in his address share with you some of the options that have been considered. But of particular relevance is that we've asked Treasury to give us additional funding. With regard to the Medicines Control Council, as you know, historically there was a battle, but there was a specific program put in place to address that in preparation for the implementation of some of the decisions that were taken to create an agency that can be self-funding. And I've got here Professor Igor, the Chair of Council and the Registrar. But I also have one of the managers of the lab, is our deputy director, who just shared some of the experiences and the challenges. She's based in Cape Town, and I thought more specifically she can share the technical details of the lab. So this is our first team, and I'd like to hand over to them to present if you allow.
Thank you very much. I think we'll just go straight to the forensic laboratories and get a presentation, and probably that is going to help us. I must say, the reason why we decided to call you is because we've seen that there were challenges in the forensic laboratories. And in fact, I was supposed to go to one of them in Johannesburg. Apparently, things were not very good there. And as I was preparing to go there, I thought probably it was important that we called you to tell us what is the state and what can be done to change that situation. So we'll give over to you, and then after that we'll make sure that we ask a few questions. Okay, thank you.
And so you want me to just sit here and do the presentation? Is that fine?
Yeah, as long as you have got this gadget.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Certainly, Chair, you are correct. Things are not quite what they should be in these laboratories. But I also just do want to start this presentation by saying it may well be that the DG has her pet in the MCC because of her past history. But the kind of attention that she has been giving to these forensic laboratories is, in my view, extremely admirable. and I'm not trying to get my promotion or my or my bonus, but I really do think that the DG is with us in turning the situation around. And in the very short while that she has been there, we are seeing a difference. And I think it is important that we are moving forward on this, and that I'm not coming here just to tell you that there's problems and we don't know how we're going to get out of it. In fact, we are in the process of trying to put in place mechanisms that are actually are going to ensure that we do serve the people that we serve, the public, as well as the criminal justice system and food safety and so on, in a way that the public should be served. Just to run through very briefly what these forensic chemistry laboratories do, essentially there are three areas of the laboratory work. The first is toxicology, and that really involves the analysis of exhibit materials for the presence of harmful substances. And this information is used by the pathologist to determine the cause of death. So it's usually non-natural death, and in order for determination of why a person died, it needs to have proper analysis, and this is done by the laboratory. So the service is mainly provided to the SAPS and to the public prosecutions. The second area is the blood alcohol analysis, and this is both drunken driving, primarily drunken driving, but also sometimes post-mortem analysis, so it's on live people and dead people, and we need to establish whether the blood alcohol levels are over limits so that we can take the necessary criminal justice steps that are needed. And the third area is in food analysis, and this involves the chemical analysis of foodstuff in order to monitor compliance with legislation so that we actually have safe food and ensure food safety. So those are the three main areas that the laboratories are involved in. There's various legislation that is covered through the work of these laboratories. Just to run through this very quickly, the Criminal Procedure Act, the Inquest Act, the Drugs and Trafficking Act, the Medicines and Related Substances Act, the Foodstuffs, Cosmetic and Disinfectants Act, the Fertilizer, Farm Feeds, Agricultural Remedies, Stock Remedies Act, the Liquor Products Act, and, of course, the Road Traffic Act. So we are important in terms of fulfilling our statutory obligations in a number of pieces of legislation. You requested to know what the staff establishment was at each of these laboratories and what the vacancies are. And on that slide, you can actually see the three laboratories. As the DG said, we have three of them serving all of the provinces. Now, we could run through with you which provinces are served by which of these laboratories, but a decision was made at some point that it was not necessary to have these kinds of very specialized laboratories in all the provinces, but that samples could be analyzed at these three places. So Cape Town, Johannesburg, and Pretoria. And the total in Cape Town is 36 posts, in Johannesburg 35, and in Pretoria 29. The difficulty is that not all of these posts are filled, and those posts in brackets actually indicate the vacancies. So, for example, in Cape Town, we're missing one section head, one analyst, five lab assistants for a total of 10. Johannesburg, we do not have a head of the laboratory. We have advertised for this, but I'm going to come back to that later. But we do not have a head. We have one section head missing, one analyst missing, and one admin person missing. And in Pretoria, one of the section heads out of four analysts, two lab assistants, one admin, for a total of 8 vacancies out of 29. So that's a significant proportion of the posts are, in fact, not filled at this point in time. It's also important to say that there was a work study assessment conducted by the department to see what the staff establishment really should be in these laboratories. And their analysis is that if we are wanting to do the level of work that is necessary and that is demanded of us, they did analyses only in the Cape Town Pretoria labs at this point, and they suggested that there should be an extra 12 posts created in each of these two laboratories. So in addition to the vacancies, we can actually say that there should be, in addition, 12 extra posts in these two laboratories. Johannesburg is in a particular and peculiar situation at the moment with regard to moving and renovation and so on. And so this analysis was not done in the Johannesburg laboratory. I think it's just not working at a point where one could do such an analysis. But I do think it is important to say that if we are going to deal with the backlogs that we have, and they are substantial, then we need extra people to be able to do the work. Maybe I should just pause at this point and just say something about the Johannesburg laboratory. All three of the laboratories have some kinds of space problems or space issues. And it was identified a couple of years ago that Johannesburg needed major renovation and major expansion. And Public Works agreed to expand that laboratory to more than double its current size. And it has been working for a long time on this building. Unfortunately, during this process of building, the work of the laboratory has not been anything like optimal levels. And while they are doing some analysis, certain sections are hardly doing productive work, and others are in a slow process. Unfortunately, also, as I say, the time frames for the completion of this building were not met by the builders who were appointed by Public Works. And so when the Honourable Chair talks about hearing about the Johannesburg laboratory and needing to go there to have a look, yes, it is important that one sees what is going on, but also important to say that the Deputy Minister of Public Works did go there and did not like what she saw, and she has personally taken responsibility to making sure that we are moving in the directions that we should be moving, and we now have a deadline for completion of that laboratory of March of next year, and at that point we should be fully functional. And then we'll also be able to do our proper evaluations in terms of exactly how many jobs we need. What is the funding that is going into these laboratories? Well, in total, all three laboratories come to a little over 44 million rand for all of them. And that's divided into just over 15 million to the Johannesburg laboratory, 12 million to Pretoria, and 14.5 to Cape Town. Let's at this point say that that's a statement of fact. The committee also asked us to just give an indication of the length of time it takes to conduct a toxicology analysis. Well, while I would like to be able to give you an answer and say that it's 1 week or 2 months or 6 months or whatever, the fact is that this is variable, and it depends on the case itself. It is possible that a case can be completed with 1 week if there are no issues and no complications, and one knows what one's looking for, and you set up the machines and get the right standards and do the test, and you find what you're looking for. But more often, it's not clear what it is that one is looking for and what the cause of the death is. And so one has to go through a whole range of possible alternatives before the correct one is found. I asked one of the lab heads to kind of give me a reasonable time for what we think it should take on average from the time it reaches the analyst to a result. And it was suggested that this should be about 2 months. But sometimes it can be longer, again, depending on the circumstances. So I'm saying I've got a week here, I've got 2 months here, and I'm saying it could be longer. But that's the nature of the game that we play. And it's not an exact science in terms of time frames. We can ask our head of lab to explain this further to us, but the fact is that sometimes it's unusual substances. And then, if that is true, we have to then get new standards to assess whether it might be that particular substance. And because standards have shelf lives and so on, we can't always keep these in stock. And so when we are looking for a particular reason, we might at that point then only have to order the standard, get it in, and that can also delay the process. Okay, I just want to run through some of the actions that we have been taking to try and deal with some of the problems. The first issue is around procurement. Now, one of the challenges of having laboratories within a national health department is that our procurement procedures are not really well geared to laboratories. And we need to get order numbers, we need to go through proper procurement processes, and it needs to be signed by the right level of person in the department and so on. So what we did is that we did a delegation up to an amount of 150,000 to the laboratory heads as a way of hastening this procurement. And I believe that it has helped quite a lot because not everything has to come to me for signature in Pretoria as it did at one time. But of course we also have to make sure that we don't delegate too much responsibility too low down. So we felt that 150,000 was a reasonable amount to give delegation to the heads of the labs who, as we've said, are at a deputy director level. We've also advertised for critical posts, and we've done our shortlisting, and we expect to fill most of those vacancies, not all of those vacancies, because the funds that were given to us will not fill all those vacancies and will certainly not cover the additional posts that we need. But there was some earmarked funds given to us, and we are hoping to fill these posts within a very, very short while. We also think that it's important for staff to keep up with the science in the field. We also think it's important for people to keep up with the laboratory information management systems and other management which is necessary for laboratories. And I think that it is fair to say that staff have been undergoing ongoing training so that we can actually run efficient laboratories. We did mention backlogs, and we did investigate the possibility of contracting work out to the private sector, to other people who might be able to do this work, but unfortunately, it would work out to be too expensive if we did this, and we don't have the money to do it, and it's also difficult to maintain a chain of custody if we do contract work out. And I think that when you do visit these laboratories, or if you do, you'll actually see the importance of having a chain of custody. These are quite valuable samples, mostly. And in fact, if they get into the wrong hands, can be used for the wrong ends. And so the chain of custody is very important, and we were worried that if we just simply contracted out, it would not maintain this chain. We also looked at the issue of overtime, and where we have been able to pay overtime, the samples have come down quite significantly. We have actually managed to do a lot more than we normally do when we have been able to get people to work overtime, and generally there has been a strong willingness from staff to do overtime. So that's encouraging. People will do it. But, of course, overtime means more funding, and from the amounts that we have and the budgets that we have, there hasn't really been enough to allocate proper funding to do overtime. We've also been worried that given our backlogs, there might be cases where we are doing analysis and the police or the NPA do not need those results anymore. They might have already dismissed the case, or they might say, well, it's too old, or whatever. So we have been in negotiations. Our pathologists have been in negotiations with the NPA and the SAPS to try and see if there are samples which we can discharge ourselves of and not do the analysis, because we don't want to have a situation where we are spending time and money on doing analysis which are not needed, especially for those that go back a long period of time. They're not that many that they are prepared to say we don't need these results anymore, but there are some. I want to address the issue of funding, because I do think that funding is key to this whole turnaround. And yourselves, and I'm sure Treasury too, would say, well, what are you doing to get efficiency gains that don't need more money? And yes, there's always possibilities for greater efficiencies, and we are working on that. But we can't, for example, improve things particularly if we're not able to retain staff, if there are not adequate supplies of chemicals when we need them, when machines can't be fixed because we don't have the money to fix them. Those things you can't do. Some of the things that we think we can do is, for example, improve the procurement practices. As I say, we started to do that. We could probably do more. We can probably motivate staff a little bit more. But really, I think unless you've got a lab that feels like it's a vibrant working place where we're doing something in the way that we should be, I think it's very hard to motivate staff. And to get it to that situation, you do need funds. You know, we just on the efficiency areas, I think it's interesting that my colleague here, who's the head of the Cape Town Lab, does have an MBA, as well as extensive experience in analytic chemistry. So it's not as if we've got people who know nothing about management running these labs. It's people who are skilled to run labs, but who find it very, very difficult to do that in the situation that we are in with the limited funds that we have. Okay, so I was saying that sometimes to change staff morale and so on can be done without funding. But I think it's very difficult when, for a long period of time, you've had a demotivated group of people who, when a machine breaks down, they have to wait a long period of time before they can get that machine fixed, or where they're given so many samples that they can't complete what they have to do, despite trying very hard to do it. So I really do think that an injection of adequate funding is critical to turning this around. Okay. So what have we been trying to do to get more funding? Well, each year we do request more funding for these laboratories. And last year we requested, I think it was 22 million from Treasury, and they managed to give us 2 million. Now, nobody's going to scoff at 2 million, and we can make some difference with this, but the amounts that we need really to do a proper turnaround are substantially higher than this. And this year, the department is going to be putting in a bid for 30 million. What is encouraging for me as an official within the department is that this is very strongly being endorsed by the DG and by the Minister. And so I'm feeling hopeful that we actually will get recognition that this is an important function, and that in order to do the work that we have to do, we need the help to do it. What we are trying to do is to say, well, initially we need a bigger amount, and then we can reduce it slightly because we want to replace equipment. And that once we've got equipment in place, it can last for 5 years, 10 years, whatever is needed. So let's give it a good boost. Let's get equipment there. Let's fill the posts that we need. Let's pay overtime if we need to. Let's look at issues like scarce skills allowances or OSD, and really get everybody moving together towards the goals that we know we need to meet for the public that we serve. So what we will do if we do get this money is we will recruit staff, we will retain staff, and I'm just an anecdote, well, not an anecdote, I suppose also a fact, that the police have forensic laboratories as well, and agriculture has laboratories as well, and both of those pay scarce skills allowances, and we don't. Okay, we don't have the money to pay scarce skills allowances, and it hasn't been agreed to. And then we get surprised when people get trained in our laboratories and leave for these other laboratories, or they leave to go to the private sector where they get paid at least double. So it is important that we actually retain staff rather than just recruit them. The training that we give them is regarded as excellent, actually. And everybody wants to snap up people who've worked in these forensic laboratories because they're well-trained staff. So we'll use it to retain staff, to recruit staff, to ensure that goods and services that are required are available when needed, and we will buy new equipment. Where management support is required, we will put in the mechanisms to make sure that we provide that management. And then we've got the whole issue of backlogs, and as I said earlier, we have got people who are willing to do overtime to help us to reduce those backlogs. And what we need is the funding to be able to pay them to do it. Just to inform you, we anticipated during the FIFA period, the World Cup, that we may need to do a whole lot more analysis of drunken driving, and we didn't know what else. So we asked FIFA to provide us with a small amount of money so that people could do overtime while the FIFA World Cup was going on. And we got people to be there to do this overtime. Very fortunately, there were very few samples that came in relation to FIFA, in relation to the World Cup. But what we managed to do while we were there was start to get rid of some of the backlogs. And we managed, actually, to get rid of quite a lot that had been waiting for some time. Now, when I say quite a lot, it's still a very small proportion relative to the numbers that we have. But what we are saying is that if we get more staff, if we can retain them, and if we can pay overtime, we do feel positive that we can actually deal with the extensive backlogs that we have. I haven't touched on the problems of premises other than the Johannesburg laboratory, but safe to say that Cape Town does need some renovation, and that is going to take some resources. And in the Pretoria laboratory, they need additional space. They're in a heritage building, and they're not allowed to expand it because it's going to change the facade. So if, for example, it is agreed that the extra 12 staff that are needed there are employed, then we're going to have to look for different premises for the Pretoria Laboratory, and that's a new challenge that we, well, not a new challenge, another challenge that we are going to have to deal with. But in the meantime, our priorities is get staffing in, make sure that the goods and services are provided when they're needed, and make sure that there's sufficient equipment to do the work that is needed. So I say thank you, and we are hopeful.
Thank you very much. I take it that I didn't hear properly your name. I think it's Professor Friedman. Freeman, not Friedman. Oh, okay. You are the director of of forensic laboratory services, or can you tell us?
I'm the cluster manager for non-communicable diseases. And honorable member, if you can tell me why forensic laboratories fall under non-communicable diseases, I would be interested to know. But it's a historical development within the department that these fall under non-communicable diseases. So it's a part of my responsibility.
Thank you very much. I think that was a good report. Obviously, as people are doing oversight, we know there are problems, but we just want to hear so that we can get out of the space hopeful that things are going to happen. Members, laboratory services is that particular area where it's supposed to be assisting the professionals to do their work properly. But this particular one, the forensic one, I think it's supposed to assist in the crime, to help them to know what was the cause of the problem. If that be the case, but one thing that we don't seem not to understand, why was it not part of the NHLS when that particular act was there? And as you know, in South Africa, we've prioritized crime. And the unfortunate part is that in prioritizing crime, the area that is supposed to be assisting has not been doing well, which is this particular laboratory services. But I'm sure we are hopeful with your presentation that probably there's something that is going to be happening. We were asking ourselves questions as to how did you manage during the FIFA World Cup, because I think that was the time when things were best, but you've tried to highlight that. With the other area, we know this is the area where there's usual corruption, where if I'm jailed for a particular thing, then I can buy somebody to change the blood samples and do. And unfortunately, you didn't go into detail about that. That's true. Do you get a lot of corruption, and how do you, with the shortages that you have and with the financial problems that you have, do you find this to be a big problem? The other interesting thing is that we've got a South Africa that is very big. And I take it that these areas were the areas that were there before 1994. And now you wonder, how long does it take to have a forensic test done in somebody who's a crocodile? How long does it take for the court or whoever or the NPA to get a response, looking at the distances? And these places are only in Gauteng and Cape Town. And there's nothing happening around Durban in the other provinces. So you ask yourself, are we doing justice, or are we really transforming this institution so that it could be able to reach everybody? There's another part which I don't know where they come in, which is the faith, the South African Institute Against Drugs and Sport. Are they working with you, or are they separate from this? Because they usually test people for use of drugs. Are they part of you, if you could just tell us? We understand the challenges of funding and premises, but I'm going to allow members to ask a few questions. I see the whip got his hand up. I see Mike. Okay, we'll start with you, whip. Then Mike. I'm not sure that I can answer. Do you want to ask a question? Okay, it will be the whip, Mike, and then Natakana.
Thank you, Chair. My question is about the vacancy rate. I've noticed here your presently is about 19. So this means out of the 190, about 19% plus minus. And even though that work study assessment conducted with the department said that you have an extra 12 per lab, that gives you about 36 approximately. So that means your vacancy rate actually is about more than 50%. So I do believe it's very difficult for you to work under that circumstances. Now, on slide 8, you mentioned that critical posts were advertised, and you were busy with a shortlist and stuff like that. But you are not clear how many posts. It's all 19, the 19 posts, is all of them. Just would like to know that. And this is one question. And then about the relevant legislation presently. If notice the different acts, you see look at the dates, the Inquest Act of the 8th of 1959, the Medicine and Related Substance Act 1965, and one of 1947. Isn't it still relevant? no need for us maybe to look into that legislation and see whether we even can change it. Thank you, Chair.
As Honourable Mike.
Thank you, Chair.
And thank you, Professor, for the presentation. Chair, just to brief you, I went to all three laboratories myself to have a look a few months back. Well, earlier this year, actually. And I just want to start from that premise, but I want to ask a few questions before I get into the backlogs, because you didn't actually give us any figures of backlogs for the three, drunken driving, blood samples, toxicology, or food, which I would have thought would have been in here. But just about the staffing levels, you say you are appointing some staff at the moment, the shortlisting's been done. How many of those posts that you said are vacant are going to be filled? If you can just elaborate on that, and for each of the three laboratories. And then, Chair, just on the actual space, I mean, none of the laboratories actually meet health and safety standards, which I'm sure the Professor would agree with, you know. In Pretoria, there's a fire, there's no fire escape at all, you know. There's huge problems at each of the laboratories, which we need to go and have a look at as a committee. So what's about the funding? And then also about the backlogs. I mean, how long will it take to get the backlogs eradicated? Now, I don't mean to be rude or anything, but if you look at slide 7, Chair, or disrespectful in any way, about the length of time it takes to conduct a toxicology analysis is variable. A case can be completed within 1 week, but more often analysis to go through a whole range of possible alternatives, which I do understand, and a reasonable time is 2 months, right? And if it was 2 months, I actually wouldn't mind, to be honest with you. But when I was there, let me just give you what the backlogs were and how long it was taking, Chair. And I can tell you now it's got worse, because each month it just the backlog just gets more and more. So the Cape Town backlog, for example, for toxicology, where an ideal time is supposed to be 2 months, where were we? It's Cape Town, 7 years. 2003 cases are still outstanding. I don't know where the 2 months comes from at all. I'd like an explanation. Johannesburg, 8 years. And Pretoria, 4 years. That's for toxicology. Now, one must understand, when people are waiting for that report, they can't move on with their lives. Any family can't. Because they've got to get that report from the laboratories in order to submit it either to insurance companies, whatever the case may be, in order to get, you know, the insurance money and move on. And many people lose their homes in the interim because of this. So that's the first thing. Then on drunken driving, Cape Town, there's two types of drunken driving. There's PM, post-mortem drunken driving. Okay. So it's between 12 and 16 weeks in Cape Town. In Johannesburg, it's 3 years for drunken driving. The court's thrown the case out and the guys got away with it. And in Pretoria, it's 16 to 18 weeks, right? And then as far as food samples are concerned, remember it's important that we're up to date with food samples because we don't want people to be poisoned, you know. Case time is 11 months backlog. Joburg doesn't do food samples, if I remember correctly. And Pretoria is 3 years. So that's the backlogs we're facing with. So I don't know where this comes from, and you know, in order, you know, this particular slide 7 baffles me, and I don't mean to be rude, but the thing is, if you're going to seek assistance from the portfolio committee, one has to be honest and say this is actually the backlog, and this is how long it's taking, and not try and cover things up. So I'd like to know, first of all, how does the professor or the DG explain this particular slide in this presentation? What is the current backlog at each of the laboratories? And we have one of the heads of the laboratories here. Maybe they can tell us, give us practical examples. And how long will it take to eradicate this backlog? And what will it take? Because this is totally unacceptable, Chair, that we have these backlogs in our country. Thank you.
What I wanted to check is that although there are vacancies, the staff establishment, including the identified 12 for each laboratory, I assume that Johannesburg will also have to get 12. I mean, whatever system has been used to reach the 12. Whether this will resolve the problem of the staffing, because mostly they complain about staffing. And I wanted to check, because they advertise posts and then they shortlist it. Do they get enough applicants? Particularly because people always talk about shortage of skills, whether they get enough. And if they are meshed with NHS, will the problem be solved of staff shortages, of accommodation of staff, etc., or will it impede their problem? And how will that improve the backlog? I mean, if once they get these 12 people, how will it move from? I take 2 months. Mike will disagree with this, or 7 years. But how will it shift the issue? How fast can the turnaround be?
Thanks. Those are the questions from the members. As I said at the beginning, is that crime has been prioritized by this present administration. And what we're talking about now is the services that are assisting in crime prevention, in making a diagnosis and trying to prevent that crime. And obviously, what is being said, I think it's an honest truth. This is what was happening. I know these challenges have been handled head-on. We've got an Auditor General's report about this, which doesn't look too well. So maybe let's give over to you, Prof. And I think if you're new, you can come in. We know you are new in this, but we want to know how are we going to help be handling this situation.
Thank you very much. Perhaps maybe in terms of the backlog, yes, indeed, there are backlogs. And we're going to be quantifying them to look specifically for us to know exactly the number of people that are needed beyond just having the staff complement and the overtime. Because I still maintain that we cannot just have the existing staff work overtime to address the backlog. I'm not sure if we'll make headway. And the question of skills, it's actually an important one. An important one because the type of analysts we have are analytical chemists, and the level of skill with regard to their qualifications and experience also differ. Having visited some of the labs, it's quite clear that we've got people with diplomas, others with degrees, some with honors, so it's variable. And we Professor Finan referred to the problem of morale. Now, if you've worked in a lab and you do routine work, you conduct the same test over and over again, it's a problem. It kills your morale and so on. So there are a lot of problems that we picked up beyond just the numbers that we have. There are a whole lot of reconstruction-related work that is needed in the lab. Now, the three labs operate differently. The problems that have been identified in the Johannesburg lab are far more complex. Now, the first problem that we picked up was that during the renovation process, I think there was a problem with planning, in that we should have relocated people first and then done the renovation. So you cannot renovate while people are on site. That was the first problem. The second problem was that the equipment that is used in these labs are fairly expensive. And we would like, and these are some of the interventions we're taking, to ensure that we secure the machines, but also the samples, because this is evidence. So, as an intervention, we've actually relocated staff And in that relocation, we're securing, and I think they'll be moving. And in that period, we'd like to see, because we've been in discussion with NHLS, to see whether some of their analysts can be used and assist us in addressing the problem. So if that is possible, we're going to enter into a service level agreement specifically to see whether we can access their scientists and analysts to help us at least clear the backlog. But that is something that we can enter into, and like Professor Freeman said, we'll see whether within the existing budget we can address that. But that will help us address the backlog. But we have to consciously go out and seek at least appropriate skills for us to respond. Now, the recent report that we saw from the Department of Higher Education reveals that we've got about 2.8 million unemployed youth. Some of them have just finished university, some have a master's degrees and so on. And within that pool, we'd like to see whether we have analysts that we can pull at least to use and recruit consciously and train to be a support system to this. But I think we still have to resolve this legal issue of when the proclamation was done of this act. And like you correctly said, Chair, that certain provisions were made where NHLS creation took over certain functions of SAIMR and others, except for forensic laboratories. Maybe we need to look back as to whether that was appropriate or not, and why specifically this particular function was not even. The last one, Chair, is about whether, and maybe this is where you can guide us, whether the kind of service that is rendered, can it be on a cost recovery basis so that the lab can actually fund its own operations? Like we said, the reagents and reference standards that are used in the lab are fairly expensive. And the procurement system of equipment and reference standards cannot be done in a manner that you procure desks and pens and you know, you need technical expertise and people who understand so that you can at least ensure that you can save funds, but also you can get the appropriate equipment and reagents as well as the reference standards. And I think these are some of the things that you've been investigating in the three labs. And this is, and I'll give over to Professor Finn.
Thank you, Titi. I think there's a question that has been posed on us as members. We need to answer it before they leave. But I hope people understood that question that was coming. We've been joined by two other members trying to increase the number of females. We've got Honorable Mafol, who came in. You can just raise your hand so that they see who. And then we've got Cheryl Dudley. Honorable Dudley, they've just joined us. I'm sure you got the invite, members, as to what you are discussing. Oh, okay. That was a response from DG. We're going to comment about it, and there's this question that we've got to answer at the end. Yes, Prof.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just after the presentation, you were talking about prioritizing crime in the country. The Development Committee of the Criminal Justice Cluster, which has been tasked to come up with strategies for how to speed up the criminal justice processes and make sure that courts are not delayed and so on, have in fact identified this and these laboratories as one of the obstacles to the criminal justice process improving. And they have, in fact, supported us in our bid to try and get more resources to these labs. So it does tie in very much with that. And, yes, we are delaying these processes. Just to try and answer some of the questions, why are we not part of the National Health Laboratory Service? The NHLS Act actually says that these should be part of the NHLS. And then there are transitional arrangements in this Act which say that these are excluded. But in time, there was a whole list of them. And in time, all of those were included except the NHLS. And Honourable Chair, I have only been in the department for about a year. I was there previously, but have only been back for about a year. And I've been trying in this year to fully understand why it is that that never happened. And it seems to relate to issues of salary scales, of who can sign off on samples. Apparently in the NHLS you have to have a 4-year degree. We've got people with 3-year degrees, so that would hold up processes. But it's quite difficult to try and understand why it has not become part of the NHLS. And as I say, I've asked a lot of people to try and get to the bottom of why. But I haven't really got to the bottom of that. Do we get a lot of corruption? I think maybe I'm going to leave that to Ms. Shillack to answer. Do you want to do that now?
Thank you, Prof. Good morning. I'm Anneke Shillack. I'm head of the Forensic Chemistry Department in Cape Town. Honourable Chair, on your question of corruption, no. We have measures in place to check that. For example, to give you an idea, if samples are received at the laboratory, we've got the security, then they go to the reception. At reception, we've got security cameras installed as well. The administration staff check, let's say, for example, the blood alcohol kit that arrives, to check and see if there's any anomalies, like a leaking sample, sample not properly sealed, sample not marked, or whatever. And then they register the sample on the laboratory information system, a LIM system. And if there's any anomaly detected, let's say it's unsealed or not properly sealed or the seal numbers don't correspond, then they print an anomaly report from the LIMS, which is then signed by the police official and the administration clerk. And then the sample is sent up to the laboratory. It's sent up in such a way that when it's registered, it gets a barcode label, and that sample is then scanned out. The person taking the sample upstairs signs for that sample that's scanned out, and then it's scanned in again to storage. So we have track on where that sample is, who handled that sample. There's also security cameras in our laboratories as well. The samples are assigned to a batch, and an analyst analyzes samples. Should there be any other anomaly detected in, let's say, sample all of a sudden are unsealed or now, so it means someone might have tampered with it, then it's reported immediately, and two persons are involved in the opening process. So that we did, I don't think there's any room, and we haven't seen any reports of fraud or tampering with samples. What we did detect is sometimes from a station that you get that there's insufficient samples that's been taken. The blood sample is too small. So there might be a corruption on that side, and then we did bring it to the attention of the police to take note of it. So within the laboratory itself, I can really say quite confidently that we don't have problems, and there are measures in place like security camera, access control in the laboratory.
You know, the reason I was asking that question, you know, the main problems that have been highlighted here is the lack of funding, lack of funding and shortage of that. Obviously, if that happens, that leads to low morale.
Yeah.
Now, when you've got low morale, then you get poor work ethics. It is at that particular time that I can easily say, look, can you change this life, or can you do this, or I can pay you this amount of money so that I don't get that particular result, because I know I'm talking to somebody who's got a very low morale for his or her work. This is why I was asking this type of question with the situation that we're seeing at this time and moment in the laboratory services.
I can also just maybe the result of the blood alcohol.
The result of the blood alcohols are directly interfaced from the instrument to the computer system, and you can't change that. So it's not that you type it in and can make a change. It's directly interfaced. And also, I would like to mention that we accredited, the Black Elkhorn section of the laboratory is accredited, the only forensic laboratory in the country, including police. It means that we work according to international accepted standards. So it's not the quality of work that we deliver that's the issue, it's the capacity. We need more people and more staff. And I'm lucky to say, in the Cape Town laboratory, I've got excellent staff, so we haven't detected that bad ethics at the moment.
We're not creating a dialogue, but you are talking for Cape Town. You're not talking about the two others. We
no,
don't know what other
people
are
talking about. Knowing them, I'm prepared to say I'm talking for at least the Pretoria lab, and I know really well. I've worked there as well.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think that certainly you flagging it is something that will alert us to just trying to make sure that we keep vigilant and make sure that we don't allow this to happen, or perhaps do a little bit more investigation just to make sure that we are not going off the road. Okay. The FIFA, I think I'm more or less covered, but I just wanted to... It was a wonderful time in South Africa's history in that we got almost no additional samples. And in fact, we're also responsible for what we call clinical forensic medicine, which really deal with victims of rape and violence and so on. And during FIFA, we made provision for additional staff and so on. And in fact, we had a reduction of the numbers of people coming in. It was a fantastic time in our history. Okay, sorry, that's just a deviation. Do the distances make it longer to get results? Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that we do have to take into account what Honourable Waters was saying, that in fact it's not that day or 2 days of the time that it takes to get from Durban to Pretoria that is the real delay. We've got much, much longer delays that are going into years. And so the extra day of distance is not really a particular issue. However, where it is an issue is that very often the analysts get called to court to testify. And then it does become an issue because somebody from Pretoria has to travel down to Durban or whatever it might be. And that takes time and that takes money. And if we had a more decentralized service, then certainly that could be avoided. And just taking KZN as an example, I mean, I do think that they do have the resources and the skills to be able to run such a lab. I don't think, for example, the Northern Cape or one of the smaller provinces would be able to do that. But it is something that we have looked at and which we will continue to look at. And certainly we think that parts of the laboratory, like the food, could really be decentralized if it was linked more closely with the NHLS, because we can't just have forensic laboratories doing food in every province. It just doesn't make sense. Okay. But also, I mean, just, Mr. Shilak was talking about these security cameras and all that. You know, if we have too many of these labs, then it will be that much more difficult to set them all up. So we have to find an optimal number. In terms of the drugs in sport, it's not part of our mandate. So this is not what we do. The vacancy rate, yes, Honourable Member, it is as high as you are suggesting it is, and really is the major cause of the serious backlog that we have. And also, as Honourable Waters said, at the moment, we're getting more samples than we can analyse. So what's coming in every month is more than that what goes out. So far from getting rid of the old backlogs, the backlogs are getting more each month. And we have to get people in to deal with the situation. I think you asked for how many were actually advertised. I just want to start with Johannesburg. We just advertised the one in Johannesburg, which was the head of the lab, and that's because of this whole moving and not working at our optimal levels in the Johannesburg lab. So to have more people there at this point in time would not make sense. We need to wait for the completion of the building, and then we can get more people. However, we do need a head there who can help us with the structuring and making sure that we move in the way that we should do, that equipment is moved in a way that doesn't affect results and so on. The Cape Town lab, we advertised 7 posts. Okay, so that was all the vacancies there, not counting the 12, of course. And in Pretoria, we advertised 5. Okay. I wonder, I've been dealing with the head of the Joburg lab, and we had, I think, something like 50 applicants for the one position. I don't know if Mr. Schillack wants to say anything about how many and the skills of the people that applied for Cape Town.
I've looked at shortlisting after 5 level 6 analyst posts, and I think I've received about 80 applicants that send up for shortlisting. The problem is not maybe on the level 6, the entry level, but also the interview will tell how competent the candidate is, because you don't only look for chemical skills, you also look for personality. You must know they must go to court, so they must present themselves in court, they must be able to communicate. So that's sometimes difficult to find that combination of chemical knowledge and be able to communicate. The problem is with the level 9 post, there we've definitely got a skills problem. And of course the salary and remuneration is so low, you don't really attract that people. So the higher levels, principal forensic analyst, that post hasn't been advertised yet, but there's definitely a problem. And then of course the problem to retain them. Of course if you've trained the level 6, it's because there's not that old progression in place yet where they can progress to a higher level. If there's not a vacant post, then you leave lost into the private sector or other lab.
Okay. The old legislation, yes, it is interesting reading to see how old some of these pieces of legislation are. Of course, there have been amendments to all of these. I don't think that any of them are in their original forms. So I think that they probably are a lot more up to date than is reflected in this. And in terms of this list here, there are only 2 acts which are actually within the Department of Health. The rest are acts from other departments like agriculture and justice and so on. And I think that the medicines and related substances, Ms. Heller will be talking about just now. Okay. Then the space issues, I agree we can't neglect this for a long time. We have to address it, and yes, I agree that there are health and safety issues. I don't know what else to say. Okay. You asked for how long the backlogs were, and you gave us the answers. If they've changed, they've changed in very small amounts. Okay. And we can give that information, or as DG said, we are compiling that information on an ongoing basis. But we still do have the large backlogs because we haven't really had the staff to address them in a fundamental way. As I said, with some of the overtime that we're doing, we actually do quite a lot more over short periods. But they are short periods, and given the large numbers, percentage-wise, they're not a big dent. Okay. And then the question of how long is it going to take to get the backlogs done, and what is going to take to alleviate the backlogs. I think what we have said is that we need to get the right staff, we need to get the right equipment, and we need to get the right goods and services to be able to do this properly. And Mr. Schillack has been talking a little bit about the skills that are out there, but in fact, very often when we do advertise, we might get a lot of applicants, but when it comes down to it, we can't fill posts. So I can't say to you it's going to take X number of years, because it's going to depend on what's out there, how long it's going to take to get people in, how long it's going to take to train them. And I think usually people say that it takes at least a year for a person with a qualification in analytic chemistry to really be efficient in being able to do samples. So it's not going to be a miraculous change, even if we do get a lot of staff. We have to be open and upfront about it. I can't give you exact dates, but what I can say is that we will slowly start reducing the backlog if we get the people and if we get the goods and services. Okay, and I think we've also addressed your issue of do we get enough applicants, yes and no. We're going to have to really see once we go through this lot, and then if we do get more funding, then there's a whole lot more that we're going to have to fill. But I also want to say that I think that this is going to depend to some extent on whether we do say we're going to pay scarce skills allowances and OSD and so on. I think that's going to be quite critical to this.
Thanks, Prof. There's somebody who wants to ask a question. I think Honourable Mike wants to follow. Okay, Member for? We are covered. Okay. Mike?
Just a few comments, Chair. The first thing is, I think, because the DG is also sitting here, so I'll take the liberty, that whenever any entity of health comes before this committee, they should give us the backlogs that if there are any, I mean, if there are any, this can be positive here. And I think coming to the committee without even, you know, briefing them properly, as I see it, and not giving them the full facts of the backlogs in each of the laboratories, I think is misleading the committees in some way. And I hope that the MCC will be giving us what the backlogs are, and not using the 2007 as a deadline, please, as you've done in your replies. I mean, the full backlogs of what's currently before the MCC. But I'm just saying, I think we need to be informed as a committee. And then secondly, I think what we can do from this presentation, I don't want to belabor the point any longer, that slide 7 can be removed from here. Because that 2 months is just... And I mean, Professor Friedman has agreed that, you know, in one laboratory waiting up to 7 years for toxicology reports, not 2 months. Okay, thank you.
Just very briefly in defense, what we were asked was how long the period it takes for toxicology reports. So what we understood by that question was how long does it actually take to do a toxicology thing. Okay, so that's how we understood it, and we apologize if we misunderstood.
Okay, thanks. Okay, Nadine.
I just want to ask that if you have looked at the process of the possibility of decentralizing the services, if you have applied your mind about what the impact of that would be, and the finances which are going to affect that if the decentralization has got to take place. And secondly, in terms of assessing, you see something. Sometimes you say there is backlog, there are people, and you say there are vacancies. But have you ever looked at the productivity during the same period and say, can we say for certain, once we get enough people, the job will be done? You know, because sometimes people say no, they work harder when there is overtime, the payment, but. Under normal circumstances, people don't work harder. You know, when they come for what they are paid for, they don't work harder. They want overtime to work harder. So I'm just looking into that thing. Whether you have compared about how hard people were working when the World Cup was here than during the normal time, because you have got to compare productivity.
I take it that you were the last one. So that if we could just get a response and then we summarize and we go for it.
Thanks, Romero. We have been looking at this decentralization issue also in relation to where these laboratories might be best placed. Because, as I said to you, in terms of the NHLS Act, these laboratories should be or could be part of the NHLS. And if that were to happen, then decentralization could take place much more easily and much more quickly because the NHLS have laboratories all around. So one could then look at, for example, shifting food to the decentralized laboratory. But I think I've also said to you that these are quite specialized, and they have the security cameras, and they have the chain of custody, and so on. And the more one sets these up, the more difficult it's going to be to, and the more expensive it's going to be to maintain these things. And I think that the control can also slip quite quickly if one decentralizes it. And then there's also the skills issue. Are we going to find anybody with this kind of skill in the Northern Cape or some of the other areas? Sorry to pick on the Northern Cape. And then can we guarantee you that if we get the right numbers, that we will deal with the backlog? I cannot guarantee anything ever, but I do feel very, very confident that we would be able.
Honourable Member, we do keep, I can just speak for the Cape Town Laboratory where we work overtime. They, for example, blood alcohol have had a norm that they have to do per month, an analyst. I think it's 600 samples per month, reports issued, not just analyzed. And for the overtime, we assign additional batches to that they must do in that overtime. And if they don't complete that, then we don't approve the overtime payment. So it's not, we do measure productivity. And in blood alcohol, the productivity is not a problem. It's like I said, it's resources. Just to give an indication, in toxicology, I've only got for July 2 analysts in toxicology section. The one analyst completed 8 cases, not samples, cases. And the other completed 15 cases. There's 15 samples. It was drunken driving samples that we had to analyze for toxicology as well. So that's basically the output that we require, about 10 to 15 cases, depending on the complexity of the case or the number of samples in a case. So, yeah, we do measure productivity, and I don't think the productivity is, like I said, is the problem.
Just the last thing. I don't think that we can necessarily say that the person who did 8 was working less than the person who was doing 15. You know, that's how difficult it is to measure this kind of productivity. Over time, of course, one can average things out, but taking one month, it doesn't tell you much.
Thank you very much. I think we need to go for tea. In case some of us are diabetic, we need to. But before we go there, I think it's important for us to know, with the shortages that we have and the lack of funding, do you think these 3 laboratories, are they enough for the 49 million population? And there's a question that DG asked. We have not answered that question. Probably we're going to answer it later because I want to hear what the members are saying on your question, whether they understood what we were trying to say, DG. But I think we know there are problems, and we want to suggest certain things. We can suggest certain things as to how do we go, because we know crime has been prioritized, and this is one area where we need to make sure that we are vigilant. There's no corruption, and everything is done properly. But we understand that there's a lack of funding, and there's a problem of shortage of staff, which needs to be handled. And maybe, members, there's a question that you never answered. Do you want to answer that question before we go for tea? No, we're going to go for tea, but I want to hear the members. What do they say? No, the question is there's a shortage of funding, there's a shortage of staff, mainly the funding. But if you look at the work that is being done there, it's the work that you can recoup whatever that you have used. Now, they want the members to help them and say, do you think this could be, could we say it must be able to recoup the amount of money that it has used so that they can buy the expensive equipment, they can do their, and they can even increase the salaries of the people.
Chair, certainly in cases of drunken driving, if you're convicted of drunken driving, the cost of the test should be added to the conviction or whatever it is, you know, the actual monetary cost. Toxicology is something different because you get poor families that wouldn't be able to afford a toxicology report. Do you know what I'm saying? So and it's normally not someone's committed a crime, the person's died. I mean, generally, you know, so I don't think families should be punished for that. And as far as the food samples, yes, if I think if companies are putting, you know, illegal or too much of something in a particular food sample, they should pay for the testing of that, most definitely.
That's
my view anyway.
But obviously, even if that happens, it would need to go through legal, whatever, the act and whatnot and other. But it's just a question that DJ was asking. Can we go for...
And obviously, it wouldn't be a general waiver, so we'd actually have to have some kind of proposal, I would say, from the people who know exactly what they would see it as, where it should be opened up and where not, and then we could just oversee that. It would be crazy for us to dig from our minds now some scenarios, because you would actually put the actual scenarios on the table, and then we could just see if we have any problem with those issues.
Thank you, Madam. I think let's go for two, but we will find time and go and visit those places and see for ourselves as to what's going on as a committee. We'll go to try and find time. Thank you. The tea time is going to be 5 minutes. The tea time is 5 minutes, eh? We've been a member of all of this time. That's another mic. Time is up now. It's time for us to give over to the Medicine Control Council to tell us what they are doing. Most of the time, Prof, when we invite people, we mention specific things that we want, but we take it that those people are going to tell us what they are doing. But we apologize for not having informed you that way. But even with you, when we say we want MCC, obviously we expect that you are going to tell us what you are doing, what are your challenges, what is going on. But we specifically mentioned a few things, and that's where we want you to concentrate, but not to say don't tell us what's happening. But we apologize if people don't understand that, but we'll try when we invite people to make sure that we specifically say that tell us what you are doing. Because most of the members are getting MCC for the first time, so they don't know what MCC is, so we need to know exactly, and tell us your challenges and what is actually going on in a very honest fashion. So thank you very much. Let's give over to you, Ms. Hela, Mandy, to tell us what's going on in MCC. But there are those specific things that we have highlighted. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. We were requested to present on the criteria for registering medicine to look at the current backlog and challenges that we have, as the Chair has indicated. By way of background, we will be speaking to the mandate of the MCC, what the policy and legislative mandates are, how we register medicine. We'll touch on the backlog with the definition of how we understood the backlog to be and deal with the challenges. The anchor on which we are directed to work is the National Drug Policy, whose aim is to ensure medicines reaching patients are safe, effective, and meet approved standards and specifications. The NDP further says, through strengthening of the MCC, rationalizing drug registration, controlling the registration of practitioners, and all those things that the department does, and promoting other quality measures like good clinical practice, good manufacturing practice, wholesale and distribution practice, laboratory practice, and distribution practice, The main act under which we act is 101 of 1965, as was mentioned by the previous speaker. It's been amended many, many times. And in our act, there is provision for fast-track licensing of essential medicines and new chemical entities with demonstrable advantages like safety profile, efficacy, or effectiveness. Our mandate also extends to issues of transparency and ensuring that there's timely access of medications to the public. And by transparency, we mean we should be able to tell the public on safety issues. We should be able to be very transparent to the applicants. We should be very transparent, in fact, to the wider population of South Africa on whatever we're doing. There are no secrets. Now, going quickly to registration, it's premised on safety, efficacy, and quality of the product. And I want to define the difference between efficacy and effectiveness. By efficacy, we understand that to mean what we see in the clinical trials, that the drug works. Effectiveness goes further. It extends to what happens when the drug gets to the general population, to practice standards, to the status of the general population, whether there are any underlying epidemiological concerns that we have, that then that talks to effectiveness. We also look at the benefit and risk ratio for that particular population. This is a mandate of the regulatory authority. And therefore that says, for instance, in South Africa, we've got a huge HIV prevalence. And therefore, whatever we do, we need to make sure that we look at whatever side effects might come up with a new chemical entity, with a generic. What is the impact going to be on what we use to treat HIV, seeing that such a huge population, entity population, is affected by that. And therefore, our label will probably be slightly different from what the North will put, where the prevalence of the disease is not as rife as in our population. That's what I mean by the benefit-risk ratio. The benefit-risk ratio also, the benefits must outweigh the risk. Sometimes, if we have a benefit and significant risk, but there's no other drug that can handle that particular condition, we would probably err on trying it out with stringent conditions like a pharmacovigilance plan, like further studies that the applicant must conduct after we have registered the product so that we can get more data and satisfy ourselves that it is actually safe and working for the population. Now, on the criteria, going quickly to the criteria for registering medicine. For new chemical entities, these are the new innovative drugs. There's a preclinical stage where the drug is tested or the investigational drug is tested in animals to assess its pharmacodynamic, its pharmacokinetic and toxicological profile. We move from that to a phase one study, which looks at toxicity. And this is done on a small group of healthy volunteers. We look at unexpected, undesirable reactions and bioavailability. Of late, we are finding that translating what is found in animals to what actually obtains in humans, there's a vast difference. And this is being continuously refined by scientists today to actually see what is going to be the best way of doing this work. But currently, we still rely on that. Phase two studies look at efficacy primarily of the investigational drug on a few volunteers again. Once that is done, there's a phase three study now. These first two phases are to filter out very dangerous things that may come out so that there's no use in continuing. We call it futility, continuing with that trial if it clearly shows that it's very toxic or the efficacy thereof is questionable and is not going to be of much benefit, and it fits back to the benefit-risk profile. Phase three studies on a larger number, very large number of participants. Oftentimes, it's a multi-center done in many countries over a period of time, sometimes 2 years, sometimes three, to determine the safety and efficacy, the dosing for specific indications, the age group appropriateness of the drug, drug interactions and side effects. They require a comparator generally, either a placebo, where ethically correct, or an active substance, another active substance, to establish whether it's non-inferior to what we know or is superior to what we know. Now, when we go to generic products, it's primarily important because generic products are not going to do clinical trials again. And this is purely for the fact that there is no need to do another clinical trial at great expense on something that is known. Secondly, it would be unethical in terms of the Helsinki Declaration to subject healthy people to an investigational drug that is known, because every clinical trial has its own inherent risk, so that is generally not done. However, the generic applicant must confirm the chemical equivalence of the active ingredient with the innovator drug. They must demonstrate proportional similarity of different strengths, say it's a 5 mg and a 10 mg and a 50 mg tablet with the innovator comparator. They must tell us what actually the drug does in the body. That's what we mean by pharmacology. How is it cleared? When is 50% of it eliminated? How it became eliminated, all those issues become important. And bioequivalence. Normally, this is about whether the drug is going to be absorbed, be attached to which sites, and so on. And usually, it's a small study that's required of 12 to 18 participants for bioequivalence, and obviously, bioavailability. Now, quality criteria, they apply to everything, be it innovator, be it a generic. We look at the active pharmaceutical ingredient. We look at excipients. Honorable members, excipients, if you are making a tablet, for instance, you are going to put in fillers like a little bit of starch here, a little bit of sugar here, a little bit of something here to make the tablet actually, so that you can crush it and combine it and compress it into something that somebody can swallow. Impurities, we also look at that, because impurities speak to the quality of the product, they also speak to the stability of the product, they also speak sometimes to the bioavailability of the product. The manufacturing method is very important, because if you're coming up with your own manufacturing method, we have to see that the sanctity of the drug is preserved. Of course, the manufacturing site must adhere to good manufacturing practice standards to make sure that the quality is correct, the specifications for the final product. We even go to the extent of looking at the container selectability. Is this container not going to react with the active ingredient? Is it going to preclude light? Is it supposed to be? I'm sure we've seen brown bottles with some of the tablets that to preclude light, tampering with the sanctity of the product and the stability. Stability, we mean that over time, in normal storage conditions, the drug sanctity is what it was at the beginning. It doesn't degrade because of exposure to light, moisture, to whatever. Honorable Chair, with your permission, I decided to speak a little bit on fixed dose combinations because it's a topical issue. We define it as a product with two or more components combined into one for very good reasons, to reduce the pill burden and to improve adherence. We see them usually in TB medicines, we see them in antiretroviral medicines, we see them in hypertension medicine. Now, from a regulatory perspective, there are four scenarios. First, two or more innovators agree to work together on the FDC. The one brings one's component or molecule, and the other one brings another, and they work together to bring the FDC. The second scenario is where a generic applicant submits a new combination, I call it a novel combination of registered products that we know, but nobody has ever combined them, and it's a generic manufacturer that is bringing them up. Thirdly, a generic applicant submits a copy of a known registered combination where an innovator has combined this, and then the generic manufacturer also brings a combined one, originally combined by an innovator. And lastly, an innovator has granted a license to a generic applicant for a registered FDC, say it's one of the big companies that are innovators that give to a local generic company, maybe in South Africa, a license or wherever to manufacture that. Now, on this last one, it is not uncommon to find that not all the data that the innovator has is given to the license holder. And therefore, that has implications on what we're going to require as regulators in terms of data. Now, the registration, therefore, will be guided by a number of factors for each scenario. Say, if two innovators combine, there's not much because all the clinical data is available and they will use it, and therefore we don't have to jump through many hoops. Where the generic company brings known ones, there needs to be additional studies to establish some of the things I'm going to highlight just now. Where it's a copy of a known combination, that data probably will be part of it in the public domain. It doesn't become too strenuous, but there's a little bit of work that the generic company will have to work on. And so those are the issues that for each scenario that we look at individually. And therefore, what we will look at is there in general principles, is there enough data on each molecular component to support efficacy, safety, and quality individually? And these are things we probably know. Then we need to know whether there's sufficient data to show that when you combine them, the efficacy is improved, because you don't just combine and you don't improve efficacy. You combine, there must be a reason. The efficacy is improved and there are no safety or quality concerns, because once you bring in two things that were originally separate, there might be issues. We also would want to know whether each component or molecule be released in a therapeutically efficacious manner. That deals with the issues of clearance, that deals with the issues of receptor sites, that deals with the issues of how is it going to actually act in the body when it is combined. We further want to know whether there is data that demonstrates the real-time stability of the FDC product. Remember, the stability was done on a single one. You combine two chemicals or three chemicals. Now we want to know whether that is going to be stable over time, not through an accelerated method, but through real-time stability. Then we look at whether the formulation aspects have been adequately addressed. Are there no interactions between the active ingredients? Is the dissolution by dissolution, is the time that particular tablet is required? Generally, we'll say maybe it should dissolve in the gut within the next 20 minutes or something. Is that preserved? Doesn't it go overly a long time? Because then that impacts on how it is absorbed and how it's going to act in the body. We look at stability issues, we look at impurities and all the things that I have mentioned. And most importantly, the safety of the excipients, because, for instance, if you are going to do a preparation for kids, there are certain excipients that are common that are not good for pediatrics. And the excipients themselves may interact with the molecules, because now we go back to cold chemistry, combining two things that were never together. And as I said, we may need additional studies. If maybe, as I said earlier, we see the risk-benefit and we say, okay, combined, we don't have the full stability data, but maybe we need 12 months and we are given 9 months. We may register it and require the applicant to continue with the stability studies or whatever study that needs to be done and submit. It's a condition of registration. And on the basis of the results we get after that period, it can be fully registered, it can be withdrawn, it can be adapted, we can do all kinds of things depending on the results and the need. I'm happy, Chair, you allowed me to go a little further than what the question asked, because I think it's going to be important for us to understand how the MCC works. We get an application dossier, and we assign that to different evaluators according to their expertise. Now, there'll be issues that relate to chemistry, as I've just been describing. There'll be issues that relate to efficacy, that the drug works. There'll be issues that relate to safety. There'll be issues that relate to quality. There'll be issues that relate to what have we learned about that particular therapeutic class, from pharmacophysical studies around the same kind of class, are the things that give us concern. So those are the things that we look at. And also we will look at scheduling. How do we schedule it? Is it going to be sold over the counter? Will it be sold only on prescription? Will we limit the number of tablets or dosages that will be given over a month or something? Those are the things that we look at. Currently, we have a complement of about 140 experts, about 30 of whom serve on two expert committees. In the past, before this backlog project, we had some experts because we had fewer than those. We had some experts, and I put 140 as the active experts, which I will explain later, that were serving on maybe three committees. We've reduced that after we started this backlog project because it doesn't give the experts sufficient time to devote to our work if they belong to everything, but also to try and define functions so that we reduce bias maybe, if I may put it in a potential bias, if I may put it in those terms. Reports are peer reviewed by at least four expert committees. The pharmaceutical and analytical must look at the quality issues and GMP issues, good manufacturing practice issues. The clinical committee will look at efficacy. That's a must. The safety people will look at the safety issues. That's a must, and the scheduling and names. We also have a committee that looks at the names, appropriateness of the names. If, say, a drug is called Mandisa and somebody that we have registered it, then can come somebody else with a drug called Mandina, then we will not allow it because the prescriber or the dispenser may be confused between the two. And therefore, we try to reduce that error by saying, please look for another name. For biologicals, we will have an extra committee that looks at specific biological things, and it depends, but at least four. Then the committees meet every 8 weeks. In the past year, they have met every 4 weeks because we were trying to deal with the backlog on our regulators. So we really pleaded with them to meet every 4 weeks, and I must say our experts obliged very, very earnestly. The peer review reports are then submitted to these committees. Peer review the work of evaluators, and the peer review report is submitted to MCC with a recommendation to register or reject the product. The MCC will peer review further and will decide to register, or it may recommend that the particular committee or committees go back and do further work, or they may reject applications even if it's not at the behest of the expert committees if they find something in their review that is untoward. And that's just a schematic drawing of the different committees of the MCC. Now, the evaluation process. An evaluator analyzes data supplied by the applicant. It's an iterative process, honorable members, depending on the quality and completeness of the data supplied and the appropriateness of the responses to questions. Generally, the evaluator for each section of the dossier will provide a report to the peer review committee, and if the quality of the data and the dossier is fine, maybe there'll be minor things that are thrown back usually to the applicant and they respond to, and that will finish very quickly. Sometimes the applicant will submit data and we ask further questions that are more serious, and it takes them a bit of time to respond. They may respond not covering fully everything we wanted. It goes back and we call it a second round and a third round and the fourth round, depending on the quality of the data. And currently, unfortunately, in the MCC, we do not have a stop clock system in place. In more mature regulatory authorities, they have what is called a stop clock. The time that the regulator has finished the evaluation, that part of the evaluation, and sends back questions to the applicant, the clock stops. And we will rewind the clock when the applicant brings in the data so that we very strictly define the time the document is sitting with the regulator. We don't have that luxury, we don't separate. So whether it's at the behest of the applicant, the delay, or is it our own shortcomings, and I'm the first one to admit we have shortcomings, it doesn't show. It just shows this backlog. I will illustrate it a little further. In principle, generally, generic applications take a shorter time than NCEs and biosimilars, because obviously, if we're analyzing clinical trial data and safety issues, it takes a little longer than when we have an already established a safe and efficacious comparator when we bring in a generic. It's normally more quality issues and bioavailability that take a shorter time than a new chemical entity, barring the issues I mentioned about the quality of the data and the responses. Now, let me deal with the backlog. Honorable Waters, Chair, we understood the question to relate to the backlog as we understood it. When the minister appointed a backlog team and announced that there was a backlog project, we defined it, this was in 2009 about this time, we defined it as anything that was from 2007 going backwards in our books. And that is how this presentation has been prepared. Honorable Waters, I sent a message to my office. If I get it back, I will respond to 2008 and 2009. But no, now we are stretching it.
That's referred to the comments. We don't comment.
We are stretching it if we go to 10 with your permission, Chair. The project team started a year ago. This is actually the 12th month. Additional technical people were appointed and some more high-level evaluators to assist the MCC. Now you'll ask why this was done by the project, why we couldn't do it. First, it was funding. Secondly, it was the remuneration level. The project managed to put the remuneration level a little higher than what government allows us to do, and we managed to get a lot of people who worked with us and with current evaluators, because the peer review and the second review was done by us, because I think we didn't want to abdicate our accountability and responsibility. It was not without challenges, because some of the people that we got had huge conflicts of interest, and we had to get rid of a few and rehire, so it's not been a very easy road, but it has helped tremendously. Through the backlog project, we managed to establish off-site storage for old files. Maybe honorable members will remember that there was a complaint from the Auditor General the previous year about how we stored our old files close to the roof, and it was a problem. We managed to get money for off-site storage or archiving of old files, but they remained live as long as the drug is on the market. We secured fireproof shelving for current files, and most importantly, we augmented the funding for the implementation of an electronic document management system, which, if we hadn't moved from Hallmark to Civitas, would have gone live, but now we have a few constraints with the move to another building with servers and so on. This is going to reduce paper, and it's going to help us with the monitoring, evaluation and monitoring of what works, because each worker, we will know on the system that this was assigned to Mary on the 1st of September 2010. We expect Mary to report in 3 months or 2 months or whatever. And if Mary doesn't report, there'll be a trigger, and somebody will say, where's the report? That's the evaluator now. And also, for transparency, industry will have their own PIN codes, and they can track their own submission as to where it is in the regulatory process without lifting a phone and us having to answer. Thirdly, it will help us with internal staff with the performance evaluation. We can see who works best way and also who needs to be mentored and so on. And lastly, we won't be cutting so many trees with the huge volumes of paper. In fact, it's a serious issue. We don't have space to keep our paper, the flow crack. We also verified pending applications as we defined the backlog, and we wrote to the industry to say on their side what is it that they perceive as being in backlog, and they responded. We analyzed each response, and we came out with a total of 2,700 for this period. Then we systematically cleared poor quality dossiers and people that had not responded on time and so on. And the project also assisted us with consolidating a number of disparate databases to fewer sets that are more manageable. And as I've said, we defined it as from 2007 paper. Now, I would like to speak, with your permission, Chair, to what pending means. Pending includes applications that are not finalized from us, that we are still evaluating, or at the behest of applicants that have not yet responded to questions that were raised by the committee or MPC. Currently, this was as of yesterday, the backlog stands at 1240 from that 2,700 that we identified. It's not all of them that were registered. Some of them were withdrawn when we asked certain questions. Some of them were rejected and so on. But that we cleaned up, and that's where we stand. And the consolidation of the databases helped with the cleaning up. We are currently conducting applicants out of this 1240 who have not yet responded to recommendations for more than a year. And people, let's say we ask for a bioequivalent study and somebody goes to do it, they're supposed to come back to us within 6 months, and if they don't come back within 6 months, it should be over. But then the applicant will say, can I have an extension of another 6 months? And with the paper-based system we've been using, it's been very difficult for us to keep track, and people have been asking for extensions as ad infinitum. So these are the inefficiencies that we are dealing with right now. This is just an example of the registration status, and I just picked on 2 years just to show that in 2005 we received 613, which were 20 of which were NCEs. During that year, we registered only 8 generics out of what we received that year. Over the years up to date, we have registered 406, stemming back from that 613. We tracked them to 406 of those 613, 11 of which are NCEs, and NCEs generally, even in the most advanced places, take not less than 2 years. And 4 of which were registered in 2006, which was within 12 months. These must have been fast tracks that needed urgent attention. We cancelled one NCE, and 34 were withdrawn, 2 of which were NCEs. NCEs are generally from innovator companies. In 2006, we received 940 applications, 20 of which were NCEs. We registered within that year 14 generics. Up to date, like 2 days ago, we had 589 registered of those 940 with 11 NCEs, one of which was done within a year, and cancelled 4 generics, and 27 were withdrawn, one of which was an NCE. This is just to illustrate the iterative processes and the processes that I was alluding to.
You've got that column that received D, which means the number that you received.
Okay, we received in 2005, yes, sir.
Yeah, then there's another one registered ED to date. What's the difference between those two?
The
fourth column.
That 406, what we have registered of that cohort up to date. Of the cohort of 613, to date, we have registered 406.
Oh, okay.
Current backlog, from the 2003 applications, there are still 108 pending. From what we received in 2004, there's 99 still pending. Out of 2005, we still have 168 pending, 2006, 321 pending, 2007, 647. That brings us to 1283. Now, I want to illustrate on the next slide. It's a little bit busy, I apologize, and I want to apologize for the next slide because what we have in our handout doesn't read like what I'm going to present for slide 20. We are still at slide 19. Here, I'm trying to illustrate what I meant by delays at the behest of the applicant. And I'm using antiretrovirals, and I use some data that I collected for another exercise. In 2007, of the applications, we received 56 ARV applications in 2007. There are 8 that are ready to be registered at the next MCC meeting, which will be on the 1st of October this year. We have 1 that we sent a recommendation to the applicant on September of 2007. The applicant has not responded. 1 since February 2008, 1 since September 2008, and so on, up to 3 since the meeting of July the 10th. We have 2 that we currently are evaluating, and the total is 22. This is just ARV. And for 2008, we had 38 applications. 2 are ready for MCC. 4 are currently being peer-reviewed. There are committee meetings as I'm speaking. 3, since December 2009, the applicant has not responded. 1 since March 10, 4 since April 10, 4 since July 10, and there are 2 long outstanding PE studies from 1 applicant, and we are evaluating 22 and 22. The next slide, the last one, which is 2009, we had 96 applications, 2 are ready for MCC, 11 are ready for, are being peer reviewed as we speak. And we have 1 since December 2009, the person has not come back to us. 4 since January 10 has not come back to us, and so on. And the total pending is 63, and 10 are still being evaluated by us. This is just an illustration that when we see things not registered, it's not as if work is not currently occurring. Now, if I may go to the challenges. One of the major challenges that the MCC has is over-reliance on external evaluators. Because these evaluators are very good scientists, eminent people, respected in their field, but obviously they've got other primary duties elsewhere. Most of them are university professors, heads of department, and it's not uncommon for us to say, Mr. Evaluator, we are expecting a report is a bit late, and we find that the professor says, I'm in China, and promoting a PhD student, I'll be away for 2 months. And there's not much we can do. It's not uncommon to look for an evaluator, you can't even find him, you told he's in Russia and he's not roaming. It is not, and I must say, the work that they do is very, very valuable because they rely on weekends and public holidays and so on, and holidays to do most of the work and night time because it's over and above their primary duty. The second challenge that we have is that the volume of safety-related post-registration updates has increased substantially over the last couple of years. What we do at MCC doesn't relate only to registering new applications. We also look at registered products. Are they still safe? And the manufacturers will come on their own, especially the innovators, and come with their safety-related post-registration updates. People will come and say, I've got another manufacturing site. People will say, I found a cheaper API, active pharmaceutical ingredient somewhere, and can you evaluate? It's a variation from what we saw on date of application, and we have to deal with those. The third issue, Chair, is, and honorable members, is that we, as government, we went for pro-generic medicine policies when we amended the Act, which was very good in terms of access, but we never matched it to personnel needs. We had a shock in 2007-08 when a lot of the innovator, popular cardiovascular and cancer, fell off patent, and suddenly we had this avalanche of the applications that came our way, and we were not prepared. And for internal people, we are government civil servants, and therefore budgets don't are not very amenable to it that we didn't expect. We work on the medium-term expenditure framework of 3 years, no matter what. Also, the therapeutic landscape is changing from molecules to biotherapy, chemical molecules to biotherapies, and this is going to have its own huge demands when we deal with these targeted technologies that target submolecular structures, the genomics, the proteomics, and so on. And it's something that we need to keep in mind because we started receiving applications for those things, but it's a different landscape altogether, and this is global. safety. Other issue that is a constraint is that we rely on general budget allocations. We do collect a few fees, but they all go to Treasury. So no matter what the pinch is, when we have that, we can't adjust because we don't have any way of gaining from that. I've already alluded to the EDMS. We're still using a paper-based system, but shortly I hope we're going to move away from that. And most importantly, poor quality of some submissions for evaluation, particularly from generic applicants. This is one of the constraints because it wastes a lot of time in toing and froing trying to get data. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, thanks very much, Mani, for that presentation. Well, obviously, the members are going to ask you a few questions. We know that drugs, they are the cost drivers of health, if I understand it well. And secondly, we've got a belief, all of us, that if there are no medicines, then it's not health. Somebody is not really doing you good. But there are a few things probably that you need to answer from us. You're talking about what actually happens to the medicines that are coming to you. You start with animals and whatnot. Obviously, one is interested in knowing what are the time frames. How long does it take the preclinical, the stage one, the stage two? How long does it take? And probably how much does it cost to do that for the private individual? You know, in South Africa, we've got this challenge of traditional medicine. And I'm told that more than 75% of our people are using traditional medicine. Now, when you get that, do you take it to the preclinical stages because somebody has been using it somewhere? And now they say, I've got this drug, it's working. Maybe that goes on with complementary medicines. You always hear on the radio people advertising themselves that I'm using this. Where do all those things go through you? Or you just find somebody on the radio saying that I've got Macobot that is working. You must come and buy Macobot, and you don't know where that Macobot comes. Who tested that Macobot? It's something that we need to know. Obviously, this one too, you're talking about the professors, the people that are external evaluators. I tend to think that this is one area that could be corrupted in one way or another, where if you've got fixed individuals, I could go and say, look, can you pass my drug, even if it has got challenges, but I want this drug to get into. Do you find those things and do you deal with them? So maybe members, you have some more questions. That is the presentation from MCC. Maybe the other thing that probably you need to answer, though, fortunately this is here. Is it good that MCC is within the department? Or it would do better if MCC is outside, like your MRC type of situation? Or the NHLS, whatever, but how do you compare those two? Members, that is it. I see Mike, I see Member Fowler. Is that the only two of you? Okay. Okay, Mike.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Just on the backlog issue, thank you for addressing it. And I hear what you say, that your cutoff date is 2007. But again, Chair, you know, I'm not criticizing, but I think it's better if the committee is informed of the entire backlog in the future. I think 2008, 2009 is very important to see what the trend is. But I'll wait for those figures with bated breath. Okay, but just about that, in the reply to a parliamentary question, the minister said that he hopes the backlog says the backlog will be eradicated within a year. And you've said the committee was formed a year ago, so. And you have had a few problems, but can you give us some indication of when you think the backlog will be eradicated properly? And I understand the complications when you ask the companies the applicants, thank you very much, for additional information. But, I mean, have you got some idea of when you think the backlog will be addressed? Then, as far as your law enforcement division is concerned, you didn't mention it in your presentation. I just want to know... are you dealing with any particular cases at the moment from the NCC, the Law Enforcement Division of the NCC?
you have replied to a parliamentary question where you say you do frequently receive complaints about sales of products and medicines which are not registered with the council. These complaints are evaluated based on the risks they pose to the public. And I just want to know if you particularly are investigating Obujani, because it's still being sold in KwaZulu-Natal. And I just want to know if you, you know, what progress has been made with that particular investigation. And then, I don't know if it falls under the ambit of the MCC chair, but maybe the DG could answer it. I'll take the liberty of asking. I believe there's a lack of calcium injections in the country. I just want to know, is the backlog with you or is it somewhere else? If you could just elaborate on that. And I think, Chair, those are my questions for now. Thank you very much.
Member for Leavunduka. Maybe you'll help us, Mandy. There are two drugs that you always find. I've just forgotten what is it made of, but I think it's an agricultural thing that they are using to kill pests, whatever. But it's called Ndiyazi Xhosak, kuthiwa liyeza ledanki. I think it has got some carbon dioxide. I can't remember what it is. You can go to the streets in Mthatha, you'll buy it. Some people are selling it. And people are using it to kill themselves or to kill somebody else. And usually they don't survive from it. But you buy it in the streets, even in East London. And the other one, which I'm reminded, is the Cytotec that is actually used by people when they want to commit abortion. They buy it all over the place. And it's all over the place. And can you tell us what is going on in these two ones? Because they're actually killing people, especially the... It is a little. I hope you are last by 10 years a little. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the informative presentation. Mine is the scenario that I once have in my constituency office. There was a husband, they were getting medicine from outside country. I don't remember what was that country. So when that medicine came into our country, it was kept somewhere, so that person said they must fill another form because that medicine was not registered in South Africa. There is a form that they are supposed to fill. So the private doctors didn't want to fill that form. So the wife went to the public hospital to ask a doctor to fill that form. So I just want to know, because I phoned that lady myself who was having those medicines. So I phoned her and she said, no, this medication is not registered in South Africa, but as South Africans, we don't deny people to get medicines outside South Africa. So I just want to know about that scenario, because the wife felt that the government doesn't want to help her because the husband was using that medicine for cancer. I think it was for cancer.
Those are the questions. And I'm not sure, Honourable Dad, you wanted to ask something?
The blockage with outside evaluators, is there something you can see that would alleviate that situation? Is there some solution that we can maybe help look at?
Those are the questions right here. I'm sure, DG, you could assist in certain areas. Or maybe you should say, okay.
Yeah, we also have in our midst the chair of council. I think attempt to answer some of the questions and hand over to the team. Indeed, Chair, the medicines are cost drivers, but we also are of the understanding that if we have a generic medicine, because they are low cost, they are supposed to reduce the cost of medicines. And I think there's a link between the delays with access. We've actually done a costing exercise to show how the longer you have, the longer the product takes in the system, the more costly it becomes because there's no competition on the market. But whether it be for generics or for products within the same therapeutic class. So medicine, the regulation and registration of medicines does impact on the final cost, and it is for that reason that it's important that we have an efficient regulatory regulatory system. The problems with traditional medicine and complementary medicine, I think Professor Eagles will probably have to respond to that, because it's always a concern when there's an unregulated market, because it defeats the whole purpose of ensuring safety, quality, and efficacy of products as it has been described. And I need to take this opportunity to say, Chair, having worked in WHO, one of the areas of my responsibility was to help countries come up with a regulatory system for complementary and traditional medicine. And it's an evolving area, because what has happened over the years is that because the Indians have their own traditional ways of healing, the Chinese have their own. When those products come to South Africa, they cannot be and should not be defined as traditional, because they're not traditional in the South African sense, and they have to be regulated. There are countries that have made progress in the regulation of traditional and complementary medicine. Canada, for instance, has a very robust system of regulating complementary and traditional medicine, as well as Australia. And I think those are the two countries with very good systems that we can learn from. But because the market is not properly regulated, the example that you shared with us of agricultural products that are used for human consumption that are poisonous, then becomes a problem. Because you have an unregulated market, you don't even know where unsafe products are and so on, and including access to Cytotec. Because Cytotec is a regulated product, there's restriction in terms of its access in accordance with the way the schedules have been determined. So in that respect, it's an area that requires careful attention. So we really need to build our capacity. And I think there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity because Parliament passed a piece of legislation. Is it SAHPRA, the South African Health Products Regulatory Agency? It's meant to establish an agency that can fund its activities, but also to ensure that you have a critical mass of technical experts that can provide a sound regulatory support, evaluation, inspections, and so on. If you look at most countries, even our border, Zimbabwe, with all its problems, with the last evaluation that we did with the evaluation, I mean with the European Union before I came here, is that this is probably one of the few things that still work where there's capacity. Because what they did, they introduced a system of revenue retention, and they funded their activities, and they were able to train their staff and also attract skills. My predecessor, when I was still in the medicines control regulatory area in South Africa, Professor Clifford, used to describe medicine regulation in South Africa as a Humpty Dumpty. And I've always been concerned to say, if we have a Humpty Dumpty, for those chair who recall Humpty Dumpty, when Humpty Dumpty falls, it can't be put together again. And that has been sort of the description that Johann Stebusch, Professor Stebusch at the time, always described NCC. Precisely because of this external evaluation and excessive reliance on external experts, in that you don't have a critical mass of people who are there full time to do the work. And we're hopeful that this new system with the law will help at least ensure that you can attract and retain staff that can do the work full time, and that you will not rely on experts as the registrar has explained. And the last one on law enforcement, I think we need a combination of police and also inspectors to do law enforcement work, because I really think we have a problem and we need to confront it. The last one on lack of calcium, I just wanted to check whether is it calcium or is it potassium, because I have understood that Adcock-Ingram had a plant. I've investigated a similar problem recently, and maybe the registrar can also verify that they were going to change their facility and upgrade it. Now, for that to happen, they must get approval from the Medicines Control Council. And what we had established was whether there was an alternative process that could be established so that you don't have a problem of lack of supply of this important product because it's needed. And just last week there was a meeting between the team with AdCop England to come up with a solution. But I think she can clarify, I don't know what the outcome is. Perhaps maybe Professor Ikos can explain.
Come on, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members. I think I'm not going to talk to the last issue, but I think I'm just going to try and give a brief opinion of where the MPC stands on some of these questions that have been asked. With respect to chems and traditional medicines, you asked essentially about quality. Is somebody actually ascertaining what the quality is and putting a stamp of approval? Well, the short answer is no. There's a lot of interest in this area in the country from a research level and even at a regulation sort of point. A lot of people are working on regulations within the MCC system. We've got a committee called the Complementary Medicines Committee, which is actually close to presenting a set of regulations to the minister on complementary medicines. Now, by complementary medicines, I mean everything other than African traditional medicines, which we have a special committee because we think it's a special challenge and it's a special group of medicines, which if you were to go back in time, that was the system that kept the people going, like in India, like in China, where traditional in China and India is Western medicine. You know, so we're saying it's very important, so we should give it if you like, focused attention. Now, that committee hasn't been all that active because we ran into problems when the minister, one of the previous ministers, brought in the council concept, and then the council, traditional health practitioners council, was never formed. So we decided not to take that forward because in absence of the practitioners who prescribe this medicine, you can't set up for them from a Western point of view a system of control. So we said, no, hang on, we're getting outside of our area now. Most of us in the MCC are Western trained. I mean, my background, for instance, is pharmacy, but also I did a PhD in natural product chemistry, which is organic chemistry. And that's the kind of background we all come into the complementary medicines arena with. So we're saying if the traditional practitioners are going to be the people prescribing and using these medicines, they must be consulted to finalize that regulation. So in short, we are concentrating on the complementary and alternative medicines. We call that CAMS, C-A-M-S. And the committee has just, I think, completed a first draft, well, let's say almost a final draft of the regulations. We're looking to put guidelines, because I think if members recall, in 97, there was SAMDRA legislation, which was promulgated without a set of guidelines and was eventually chucked out under protest from the pharmaceutical company. So we are busy now finalizing a set of guidelines which will tell applicants as well as MCC how to actually regulate those medicines. So we're saying, for instance, as a first round, let's control quality. And by quality, I always tell my students, is essentially, does the medicine contain what's on the label? Does this water contain, you know, the 10 elements or minerals that's here and the rest? So in medicine, I don't think any of us ever go into a pharmacy and in our minds query whether we're actually getting what the label says. I think we trust the country, we trust the MCC, the way it stands, even with its backlogs at the moment, to control the quality of medicines on the market. So we never go into pharmacies and think that we're going to get counterfeit medicines, which happens quite a lot in other countries. So the system is quite rigorous and robust. But of course, like any system, it's open to abuse if you know, have malintentions. So with respect then to the complementary and traditional medicines will receive special input. We're not quite there yet. Complementary and alternative medicines, we're close. We think we're aiming that by early next year we will hand the minister a set of regulations for consideration, also the guidelines, and it will probably come through the portfolio committee on health. With respect to corruption, annually we sign a document stating what our interests are, whether we do, even through the universities, whether we get grants from company X, Y, Z. We will state at each meeting, every meeting of a committee, people sign to say that the interests are still the same or they have changed, and if they have changed, they must tell us what the conflict is potentially for their work. Because like we always say in South Africa, there are not that many experts in pharmacy or medicine. There are not that many. And when one looks at specialities in medicine, for instance, I mean, you're probably looking at 120, you know, just to tell you the magnitude of specialities in medicine. Now, that's the kind of number that I've read from time to time. So you can't have 120 specialists of every sphere of medicine on the MCC. So we, in actual fact, do have to, from time to time, make use of experts who do have conflict of interest. But we may need them just for one opinion on a particular agent. And then we will ask them to fill in a form to tell us that they will handle this confidentially and that they will not, you know, sort of extract any intellectual value out of this for themselves, as much as one can do that. But we try to, if you like, block corruption or the tendency to corruption. And it's very difficult when you're talking to academics. As you know, we don't all create new information. We lean on each other. We stand on each other's shoulders. When I find out this, somebody else comes along and says, well, why don't we do that with it? And then the next person will say, no, but now you can actually apply this to 10 other topics. And so it goes on in science then. Develops, and that's why you have different qualifications in science, where you end off with a PhD and Doctor of Science and Doctor of Medicine, and all those indicate that people have actually researched, done things which are good for society and for science in general. So corruption is possible, it's not impossible, but I would say that if Mandisa shows the table with all the different committees, now on average each medicine goes through at least 5 of those committees. So the total package goes through 5 committees. Then it comes to council, which has 24 people in it, all independent, and none of them work outright for government or government departments or for industry. They all come from universities and hospitals, etc. So there are 24 people on the council. And those people then, essentially, we think are quite independent. But nevertheless, they all have to fill in this form regularly. The Ubajani incident, I think the MCC and myself and the registrar, and these have made a statement, and we've said that this essentially has not been accredited by the MCC. And it becomes a legal case. And the MCC on its own never starts legal proceedings against anybody. It's normally reported to the DG, and the DG then decides what to do. And there are a number of cases which are up on appeal for the Minister's Appeal Committee. So there are lots of legal challenges of the MCC decisions, and then we have to actually make a delegation that goes to the appeal committee. So even our judgments are questioned from time to time, but that's fine, we don't actually mind. It's good for everybody that decisions are challenged. With respect to the I think it's the organophosphate that you're referring to, with respect to people killing each other and killing themselves and sort of desperate times that we live. And similarly, Cytotec. Now, organophosphates are controlled by the Act, but also by the agricultural legislation. That is obviously out and out, depending on what level of transgression it is, either a legal case or it's a medicine case. But I think it's the law enforcement who reports essentially to the DG that has to take up these issues. So So we do entertain reports from individuals, from inspectors, from the community, and we take that quite seriously, and then we make recommendations to the DG. And the DG in the past, and I'm sure an honorable new DG will take these matters up accordingly. Cytotech, I mean, this is quite an old issue, because when the Termination of Pregnancy Act came into being, the MCC considered this, and in actual fact even spoke to the company about Cytotech. And I don't want to open up the whole, because it's, you know, passionate to some people, but the whole issue of abortion was discussed with respect to Cytotech and the help of softening the cervix and all that when you take Cytotech. But in actual fact, I remember at the time we asked the company whether in actual fact they would put it in their package insert to tell people that they can actually use this as an indication. And they refused to, because of all the pressure groups around the world. And we said essentially that if government wants to use it, well, you can use it, but then you use it off-label. And essentially off-label means you don't use it for any, or you use it for indications other than what's in the package insert. So you can, as a program director, namely government directing its own public health program, you can actually elect to use Cytotech in an off-label, but then it is responsible for any mishaps. But there's a set of criteria that one uses for off-label use. And one of them I remember, because we took advice from Professor Strauss at UNISA at the time, and his opinion was that off-label use is anything that at an international level has received the approval of the people specializing in that area. So ONG people throughout the world were using Cytotech for that in a lot of the countries around the world. And in his opinion, that could stand up in court and carry weight against not using this. So, you know, it is, and if people are selling it off prescription, then that is a transgression which must be reported to law enforcement. The issue of Section 21, if you read the Act, it says anyone may buy the drugs not registered in the country from wherever it's registered, but they must get MCC approval. And MCC has always said, well, it's better if such people who need those drugs actually are guided by medical practitioners in the country. So while it's not written in the Act that you have to have a doctor's support, we think from a responsibility point of view, we must guide people who want those Section 21 drugs, those registered elsewhere, to be guided by their doctors. Because I think, as the registrar said earlier, Marcella, that at the end of the day, the MCC must make sure that medicines are safe for people, that they're not toxic, but also that they're not ineffective. That we don't ask our people to spend money in the country for medicines that have been untested, which is the case with the camps, unfortunately, although some of them look very glossy, etc. Not all of them are compliant quality-wise. So it is quite a challenge. But in saying that, a number of companies, I think 200 of them, have told us that they have their own code of quality. Now, I haven't seen that, and I think, included that in comments to the previous 2008 Act on CAMs. They've put in public comments, and they've included the company's names who actually do, as they put it, guarantee quality. Chair, the last point I want to make is just to say that the MCC people, the in-house and also the experts, and the DG mentioned this earlier about SAHPRA, all of them work tirelessly and in their own time for the MCC, obviously with remuneration. But as the DG said earlier, these are people who are full-time in charge of departments, they're getting their own careers into place, but they make time. And I mean, a day or two out of a top academic's life is a lot of time, but it's done on a regular basis. in the case of our clinical committee, for instance, they probably meet every second week to deal with reports, and an average, if we're talking averages now, an average report from a clinical evaluator is one which is written after about, on average, 20 hours of evaluation. So each clinical application takes at least 20 hours from the clinical expert. It takes probably about 5 hours from the pharmacy expert, and then depending on what type of drug it is, it'll take 5 or 6 hours from some other. So you're looking at 30-odd hours on just one drug, and these are from top people. If you're training people, it takes even longer. You know, so it's quite a challenge, I think. But I think I just want to put on record that we are very thankful, both as an MCC and as a country, for our experts who contribute very unselfishly to this, and they continue to do this, and they continue to do this at one stage without remuneration, because there was an issue whether or not you're employed for the state, can you actually claim? And we were told the answer is no, because the Public Finance Management Act says you can only have one boss if you work in the state. But anyway, that seems to have been cleared up to a certain extent now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you,
Mandy, you want to add?
First, Chair, before I respond to the questions, I want to apologize to the committee for seemingly speaking to, referring to Honorable Water, just that particular issue he had asked the parliamentary question on. And I apologize profusely. The first question I want to refer to is the time frames, the development side, the clinical trials and the cost and so on. Those are outside our purview, but they cost millions and millions of dollars. But that's not part of our work, that's the development aspect. The other question that has not yet been answered was on the total trends. And I have received in the interim a message. In 2008, we received 762 applications. So far, we have registered 62. Withdrawals are 2. In 2009, we received 1533 applications. Currently, we have registered 41. 41. Withdrawals are 22. Then the other question that was raised by Honorable Mafole, I think Professor Eagles responded to the permit issue. It's on a compassionate ground, so we normally oblige.
It would be interesting to know whether during the FIFA World Cup, didn't we have a lot of those? During the FIFA World Cup tournament.
There was a special dispensation, Chair, an act was passed to relieve it. And then there was a question on when the backlog will be abolished. That's a difficult one because it's out of my hands when applicants will respond or not respond. What we can do if the committee allows us is after the last council meeting of this year, which will be in early December or late November, we can give an update. I think the other questions have already been responded to.
That's going to be the last one.
A question you asked with regard to, is the MCC well placed as it is within the department? Should it have a different kind of setup? Maybe we should ask it a different way, something like what are the pros and cons, or because obviously it's a difficult question for people here to be answering. So if you can think of a better way to word it that people can actually just throw out some thoughts. We would have to come to our conclusions from that thing.
It was going straight to the DG. It was not going to them, it was going straight to the DG, that's right.
Can I say, Chair, the Honourable Members, there is already a law to establish an entity as an entity that can generate its own funds and employ its own staff. It's already an Act of Parliament, I think. Can you protect me from that?
You have protected.
I think at the moment there are certain gaps that have been identified in the legislation, and I think those have to deal with the governance of the structure, because the way the law is written is that it assumes that it will be created in the same way as you have the South African Revenue Service, where you have a commissioner who reports to the Minister of Finance. So the question is, with the way the MCC is structured, you know, with the revenue service, you can collect revenue and so on, and there's some appropriation gets. With this particular legislation, can you live with the complexities that have been described? Can you leave the decision making process in the hands of a CEO or the register? And I think this is probably what you need to consider. But in any event, what we are busy with at the moment is to finalise the regulation so that this process can be facilitated and fast tracked. And we're hoping that by the end of this year we'd have gone through that process. But I still think that we probably need to interrogate the governance issues. What is provided for in the system is that you'll have an advisory committee. But that advisory committee does not have teeth. It's just advisory, which is contrary to what we have presently. The Medicines Control Council has certain powers and so on. So it's something that you probably have to look at carefully.
As long as you know that it's being handled. Now, only two hands that I've got now, and after that, I think we'll call it a day. Okay, Honorable Waters, and then Honorable.
Okay. Just a question and a comment. The DG briefly talked about the calcium injection issue and said the register was going to talk more about that, about the accreditation of that facility. If you can tell us where that is and what's happening and what measures are put in place to ensure that hospitals have these calcium injections. And then just on the Obajani issue, I hear what the professor said, that the MCC doesn't normally lay charges or initiate criminal procedures. But given what this person is doing, I mean, he's encouraging people to stop taking ARVs and claiming he has a cure for AIDS, that one would think that, you know, when all is said and done, that the MCC would be taking this particular issue up. I'm sure that others with vigor. And so my appeal is to the DG, because the professor said that it's up to the DG to make the call, that the DG looks at this matter as a matter of urgency and takes legal action against this individual who is continuing to sell Obajani to this day. Thank you.
That's like, I'm wondering whether we are the voted people ourselves. Now, whatever that we're doing it to protect the people that voted us in. Now, if we happen to find something wrong, is it not us who are supposed to take it up and make sure that we talk about it? But I'm just asking a question, but I think they will answer. But we've got a responsibility too, as ourselves, as to what do we say when somebody says, don't take this drug, take this one, and we know that it is not working. Because they are there as technical people to tell us that this one does not work. And it's up to us to say, look, this is not good. Okay.
Can I say that, over and above legal action, there are certain provisions in terms of the Medicines Act that can be invoked. And this has to do with the prohibition of sales. I think that can be relied upon. But also there are certain... We can also publish information for the purposes of alerting the public. I think there's a specific section that says the Medicines Control Council can make certain information available to the public to say, for instance, to warn the public if there is any potential risk. And so I'm just saying over and above taking legal action, there are certain provisions that we can rely on. We can explore those and advise council accordingly. But in addition, we'll send inspectors out.
Can I just clarify one point?
my predecessor, Dan Cola-Barnard, who served in the Health Committee, I think 4 or 5 years ago, laid charges in relation to the Medicines Control Act against Mr. Gwala. And the police have lost all records of that case, even though we've got proof that we opened the case again. And that was in a reply to a parliamentary question as well, that they know they have no record of us opening a case against them. So just telling you, we've tried from our side, and we do keep asking questions about it continuously, so, you know.
Can I make a suggestion that maybe before the weekend, can I sit with the DG and then we look at this thing? Probably we'll invite somebody from MCC to be part of us, but we need, it's something that we need to talk about. I'll be talking as a politician. Though I think it's slightly different with the Saturday because it's something that is regulated already. This other one, it's not regulated and they're doing their own things, but it's something that we can look at that too. I'm not sure, Mike, before Member Ford, I'm not sure if your question about calcium, what is it? I wanted to understand, but if you understand the question, then you can respond. Before you respond, let's ask the Member Ford to ask their question and then you can.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Professor, for that answer. What I want to know now is, our doctors, public doctors, allowed to help our people to fill those Section 21 forms? Because private doctors will understand that they know that if a person, it doesn't mean they don't know those medicine. They know those medicine, but they are just afraid that this person will come back and pay and go back. To us as a government, it's a relief for us, because if that person get better, it will reduce the rate of the sickness here. So I just want to understand that is our public doctors allowed to help people to fill those Section 21 forms? Thanks.
Yeah, I'm sure you can answer both questions, starting from Mike's question. But I think the other important thing here is that if I'm getting some form of an antiretroviral from Zimbabwe and I come to South Africa and it's not there in South Africa, then obviously the next thing that is going to develop is resistance. And we'll have a problem of resistance. But this is something that goes on to that same question.
Just very briefly, that's what I was going to say. I think somebody must take charge of the fact that this medicine is going to be given to one of our people. So it can be the superintendent of the hospital, if he's he or her is the only permanent person there, or it can be doctors if they're going to be there all the time. Because remember, this will be medicine over a period. But also what happens at the MCC is we've got a special, well, this sort of falls under the clinical committee. But the clinical committee has a doctor in-house that looks at all the reasons why and wherefore. And then if, for instance, there are similar drugs or better therapy in the country, that would be one of the sort of answers to the question. I'd say, now, hang on, first tell us, why do you want to go back in therapy now and use something that's inferior to what you've got on the market? So there will be that kind of questioning as well. So the patient will be benefited, if you like, by that. But yes, the public sector doctor could be the person who supports this, because the doctor would have to look and see if the person is affected by this particular medicine. Mm-hmm. For instance, are they getting rashes? You know, is the tummy working or something like that? And that's what the doctor would then have to report to the MCC, because there's then an onus that the doctor has to report, and the MCC will go back to the doctor from time to time and say, well, is the patient still on this? And what do you think is happening? Nothing? Well, good and well. Continue. So there is some oversight that the MCC provides as well. So we will help when necessary. And I'm sure the registrar will entertain any request like that. That's our contact person.
Let us down the calcium.
Thank you, Chair. What happened is we sat down with the company and we worked out a way, because these were GMP issues, general good manufacturing practice, and we worked out a way of minimizing the risk of contamination and poor quality by the sequencing of the production, so it's been solved. sequencing of the production to say yes. So that's what I think that this was 2 weeks ago that we sat down with them and went through the process. The
Are you saying, Mandy, the problem was with the MCC?
No. The problem
with the
was with the company. As the DG said, they were upgrading their site to fit into good manufacturing practice. And during the migration and upgrading, there were certain things that were not in place. It's like when you're renovating your house inside.
No, but it seems that DG was talking about potassium. Mike is asking about calcium.
No,
who is giving us this?
I think it's potassium. I'm speaking under correction. I know it's one of the K's or the C's or whatever. But I'm not 100%
sure. Maybe, Mike, let's agree that it's potassium. Let's agree that it's potassium, Mike.
Okay.
It's not calcium.
The second issue that was raised, I just want to allude a little bit to the cytotech issue. When we pick up these signals from the market, then we take it to the Pharmacovigilance Committee of Cancer, and they do the whole investigation on safety and what. Then we issue a statement. We warn the applicant if there's anything that we have to take to the applicant. We review the scheduling if there is need. There are lots of things that we can do. And then a statement will be issued to both providers and a general public statement that everybody can understand on the pros and cons and the dangers of whatever medication that we receive the report on. And I'm not sure where the loop in the distribution chain is, where these things get to the market. And we will look at all those issues as well.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks, Jan. Just for information, there are lots of drugs which companies take off the market, sometimes just based on economic decisions. You know, they might not be making enough money from it. The market might have shrunk, cost them more, too much to make it. They could be making something else and making more money. So there are lots of those, and the MCC, even from its own counselors, always gets these questions as to what are we doing about making these companies report such decisions to us. And we always say, no, hang on, it's not our decision, it's the Department of Health pharmaceutical section, or, you know, that must keep an eye on that and do surveillance and check on that. But I have no doubt that the honorable members will from time to time be confronted with those questions. Why are we allowing people to practice or put drugs on the market if they just irresponsible and take it off when they're not making enough money? That's something I think, I don't know how we address it. My opinion is we should probably ask the pharmaceutical policy and pharmaceutical planning method section cluster to handle those things. Because it happened to us with reserpine when it was put onto the list, the essential drugs list. Suddenly nobody had reserpine in the country, that it was a starter medication, and it cost us a lot of money to supply that to the public sector. So that happens all the time as well, you know, just seeing we're talking about shortages now.
We've come to the end. Maybe let me give you DG just to round up whatever that you want to say.
Thank you very much for giving us an opportunity to brief the committee. But like I said, we'd really like to we're actually doing a review of various pieces of legislation, because we also established that there are certain areas where there are gaps and conflicts, and we're trying to improve that so that it can facilitate our work. But in particular, we're also looking at strengthening the capacity, because I think the weakness is once a product is on the market, we also have to ensure that, because every product has a life cycle, and in that period, we have to ensure that the quality, efficacy, safety issues are maintained all the time. And in that regard, we have to ensure that there is enforcement capacity, and this is probably an area that needs to be strengthened so that we can deal with the problems with Cytotec, which is on the market, and it shouldn't be the poisons that you referred to and other products that are unregulated. And I think that is probably one area that needs to be strengthened. And I see the opportunity with the proclamation of this act and also the regulations that can come into force quicker. It can help us at least with a regulatory agency that is functioning and we can assure South Africans of safe medicine.
Thank you very much, DJ. I think we've come to an end. But I think one of some of the reasons why we decided to call you here, as we said, that this is a cost driver. At the same time, a lot of us think that medicine is all about being healthy. So, well, we've got that attitude, but I don't think it's a bad attitude, but it is not true. But at the same time, medicine can be very dangerous. And as parliamentarians, we need to know so that we can understand what is going on and we can advise on certain things. But I think we're going to be waiting on DG on this thing of making MCC to work better and not be hampered by anything. And we understand that you can definitely reduce corruption if there is, because you are dealing with professionals. Unfortunately, health is a very technical department. So we'd be calling you time and again so that you could tell us some of these things and we understand so that we can talk to our communities, those people that voted us in. So thank you very much for your report and we're hoping that this has really opened our eyes in certain areas and we're going to be troubling you. The more you give people information, the more they ask you questions. So don't be surprised when we write letters and ask you a few questions. Thank you very much. The meeting is over. Thank you.